This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to try something completely different because... Well, let's just call this Intelligent Medicine Potpourri. You know, during our weekday shows, we often interview distinguished guests, and that leaves me little time to share some of the stories that I come across over the week by reading medical journals and following stuff in the popular press. There's an enormous amount of incoming stories, and so during the weekend show, we get to catch up. We got a couple hours to share with you, but then we get a lot of calls, and some of the stuff ends up on the cutting room floor. So from time to time, we do a potpourri kind of show, which is miscellaneous stories that I'd like to comment on and share with you. And so we'll start with this one. Headline, suboptimal diet is associated with excessive mortality from cardiometabolic diseases. This is a very, very interesting study. They did an analysis of dietary factors that might contribute to cardiometabolic diseases. Okay, we're talking heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes. And what they found was amazing. Nearly half the deaths, fully one half, were related to poor nutrient consumption, including high sodium intake. I know that's controversial, but there is some evidence that at least in some susceptible individuals that too much sodium is a problem. But above all, low intake of nuts and seeds contributed to risk. Here's how they broke it down. They identified 10 specific dietary factors. For example, consumption of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, sodium, nuts and seeds, processed meats that were associated with cardiometabolic disease. And they estimated the number and proportion of cardiometabolic disease-related deaths associated with suboptimal intake of each food. And here's what they found. Suboptimal intake of 10 dietary factors with too much or too little, too much of the bad stuff and too little of the good stuff, accounted for an amazing 45.4% of the over 700,000 cardiometabolic disease-related deaths in 2012. Can you imagine, you know, what an incredible toll that is? Because, you know, we worry about deaths due to guns in America, of course, a terrible toll in terms of urban violence and senseless incidents. And we want gun control. We want to ban the sale of guns. And yet it's but a tiny percentage of this over 700,000 deaths that occur due to poor dietary intake. The largest contributors to these deaths were high sodium intake, which accounted for, they estimate, 9.5% of all the deaths. Low consumption of nuts and seeds, which was actually a close second, 8.5%. So amazing protective effects of eating nuts and seeds. As well as a high intake of not just meat, but processed meat. Okay? So, but they actually discovered an encouraging trend. Between 2002 and 2012, cardiometabolic disease-related death fell by 25%. And some of it comes with medical advances, better drugs, more rapid treatment of patients who are experiencing heart attacks and strokes. But the real breakthrough, the greatest effects, came from improved intakes of healthy fats and nuts and seeds, and a lower intake of sugar-sweetened beverages by the populace in general. And they also did a study, and this is not included in this story, but recently they did a study where they actually measured levels of trans fats in the bloodstreams of Americans, and they found that they were dramatically lower than they were 10 years ago, the result of now improved labeling of foods and outright banning of trans fats. And that could be an important contributor to this trend of reduced death from cardiometabolic disease. So they say these data have value for public health professionals who plan population-based initiatives and for clinicians who advise individual patients. Well, I say, duh, that's what we've been doing for a very long time. And that's really at the crux of nutritional medicine, when you can reduce the death rate by nearly half due to cardiometabolic disease through simple dietary measures. That's an extraordinary contribution to the health of Americans and incredible savings to our healthcare system. Okay, when your kids' first teeth come out, their baby teeth, it's an occasion to do a whole number around the tooth fairy, and then they get a little reward after putting the tooth under their pillow. And do they really believe in the tooth fairy? They certainly believe in the payoff at the end of the process. But there may be, it turns out, a good reason to hold on to those baby teeth. This, according to an article in the Washington Post, Rachel Chernansky, health reporter, reports that researchers like Manish Arora at the Icahn School of Medicine, Mount Sinai, New York, by the way, it's a environmental medicine HQ. It's a place where they study the effects of the environment, especially on kids. We've talked to Dr. Philip Landrigan on this program, who is a big proponent of environmental controls so that kids are not exposed to toxins early in life when they're vulnerable. Dr. Arora has used specialized equipment, which he's developed in ways to analyze what's contained in the rings that are in these teeth. You know, tree rings really tell us a lot about trees. You chop down a 1,000-year-old tree, and you can tell a lot about climate, environmental stresses. And similarly, you can deduce a lot about what kids have been exposed to by analyzing the pattern of tooth rings. And this is all part of, and I'm going to give you a new vocabulary word, the exposome. The exposome. Like expo, followed by S-O-M-E. That's a term that was actually coined back in 2005 to refer to the totality of health-affecting exposures that a person experiences. And this is truly environmental medicine, because we don't just ask, what are your symptoms? We ask certainly about family history. Some of this is genetic. But a lot of what happens to people has to do with what they encounter in the environment, whether they experience toxicity, exposure to chemicals, exposure to drugs, exposure to in utero, to things that mom took. These are all part and parcel of what makes us us. So they say here, in this article, from childhood asthma to adult obesity, people are hypothesizing that exposures that occurred even when your mother was pregnant with you can be influencing your risks. So there's a guy who is different guy. He's at University of California, Dr. Steve Rappaport, an environmental health professor, is studying blood samples from about 3,000 newborns to see what differences they may show between those who developed leukemia later in life and those who did not. Okay. Maybe we'll be able to trace it. They say that it's not even a matter of whether or not you get exposed. It's about the timing of exposure. There may be critical times in development that may affect your risk of getting cancer, your risk of getting heart disease, your risk of becoming obese, and so on. Even your risk for Alzheimer's disease. They say there are implications for a host of adult onset conditions from Alzheimer's to heart disease that are increasingly linked with things that happen early in life. And that's also why it's crucial when you're raising kids to put them on a very, very clean diet, provide them with freedom from exposure to environmental toxins via food and water. There's a whole new style of child rearing that is exceedingly important in terms of what happens, not just to the child in the here and now, but what may befall that individual later in adulthood. This is the study of the exposome, and I think it's going to be a word that you're going to hear more and more about, because we're coming up with better and better ways to characterize the chemicals that we've been exposed to. Often we're exposed to clusters of chemicals at once, and these have a profound impact on our development, things in the air, food, our microbiome. We live in a very complex world, and people are studying the exposome are trying to give the medical community tools to deal with how the environment shapes us and may lead to future disease. Postpartum blues can be a serious problem because statistics show that postpartum depression occurs to some extent or another in about 75% of women. And there are a variety of factors involved. I mean, number one, women may be iron deficient after pregnancy. Women may have thyroid issues after pregnancy. There may be hormone switches that are devastating to mood. And so here's a study on a nutritional solution to postpartum blues. And it's in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, which is a very well-respected medical journal. And what they did is they took a dietary supplement consisting of the following: tryptophan, tyrosine, and a concentrate of blueberry juice. Now, we can understand the tryptophan and the tyrosine because tryptophan is a building block for serotonin in the brain, and tyrosine is a building block for catecholamines, which are the feel-good hormones, noradrenaline, dopamine. And blueberry juice is just brain food. Well, we know that blueberry has benefits in terms of slowing dementia. The proanthocyanidins have beneficial effects on the brain. So they threw in some blueberry concentrate into this dietary supplement as well. And they wanted to see if that could counter the effects of postpartum neurotransmitter disruption. Okay? The supplement was given to 21 women. It's a small study. On postpartum days 3, 4, and 5. And what they found was, in the control group, which didn't get anything, most women's depression scores were much worse at 5 days postpartum than prepartum. Okay, so they experienced postpartum blues. In the supplement group, the average depression scores generally did not increase after delivery. So, you know, it's a small study, but it's published in a respectable medical journal. And clearly we need larger, better designed studies to see if postpartum depression can really be prevented by simple nutritional strategies But clearly, I think this is an important area for nutritional intervention. Women should be prepared to stave off postpartum blues by taking these harmless nutritional supplements, because what's the alternative? You could take a potent antidepressant, but that would make it problematic when it comes to breastfeeding, which is ultra important after a baby's born. You don't want to necessarily transmit a lot of drugs to the developing baby's brain, and it would be infinitely preferable to find a combination of a couple of amino acids and blueberry juice as an alternative to potent antidepressant medication. And this is a serious problem, because you may say, well, okay, you know, go through it, deal with it. But sometimes it is extremely demoralizing to women. I've seen it to the point where they feel extremely guilty that they can't cope with their baby's needs, that they, at a joyous time, feel down. And it interferes with that important bonding that needs to occur early in life. It's almost like they have a baby, something that they've been striving for so long, and then they feel bummed out and disappointed. And so dealing with this should really be a priority. Okay, one of the strategies that we use at the Hoffman Center for dealing with autoimmune conditions is low-dose naltrexone. We've done programs on low-dose naltrexone. Low-dose naltrexone is a customized medication made by compounding pharmacies, a low dose of a medication that's used to revive addicts who've OD'd. Now, emergency responders are equipped with the equivalent of EpiPens loaded with naloxone or naltrexone to inject into addicts who have OD'd, and it snaps them right out of it. It also has the effect, when given to addicts, of blocking the effects of opiates. So it's a strategy for dealing with opiate addiction. So what the heck, what business does that have to do with dealing with patients with autoimmune conditions and complex medical problems in integrated practices? Well, it's a popular therapy around my practice because we use it a lot in patients with ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. These are autoimmune conditions. We use it in patients who have rheumatoid arthritis. We've used it in patients with lupus. We've used it in patients with psoriasis. And it often helps to improve the situation. We've also used it in patients with conditions like intractable skin itching, eczema. It's not one of those things that is earmarked for one specific condition, also multiple sclerosis. It's something that generally helps to reboot the immune response, to normalize it, reduce the body's tendency to attack itself, go on a rampage, and destroy tissue, whether it's in the brain or in the joints or in the gastrointestinal tract. It turns out that fibromyalgia may have an autoimmune component. And we've also used low-dose naltrexone sometimes in patients with chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia. And it's actually, when you're doing so many things at once for these patients, it's frankly hard to know which of the components of our multifaceted, multi-pronged nutritional and supplement program have the most efficacy in terms of making them better. Many of these patients report remarkable improvements. So is it the diet? Is it the supplements? Is it the low-dose naltrexone? It's hard to pick apart. And we're not really doing controlled experiments in my practice. We're trying to get patients better as quickly as possible and as expeditiously as possible. So we'll use a combination of treatment modalities, including low-dose naltrexone. So here's a study, and it's very reassuring about the potential for low-dose naltrexone to help fibromyalgia. One characteristic of fibromyalgia is that many patients have high levels of what are called cytokines. Cytokines are chemical messengers of inflammation. They have names like IL-1, IL-2, IL-4, IL-5, IL-6, IL-7, that stands for interleukin, interferon, TGF, which is transforming growth factor, TNF, which is tumor necrosis factor, GCSF. These are all sort of a complex panel of inflammatory cytokines. I mean, if you did this on every patient who came into the office, it would cost thousands of dollars. This is for research purposes. I mean, we'll do some of these sometimes to find out whether a patient is suffering from autoimmunity. But chances are, if they're having chronic bodily aches and pains, which seem to be indicative of some sort of autoimmune process, they're going to have elevated levels of this. Okay, so they put these people on the low-dose naltrexone. They found a 15% reduction of fibromyalgia-associated pain and an 18% reduction in overall symptoms. So that's good, right? Because who cares whether the blood levels of these things declined, which they did. They were reduced plasma concentrations of all of these alphabet soup cytokines that I just referred to. But also, more important, because whether or not you have changes on your blood test, less important than where the rubber meets the road, which is, was there a reduction in fibromyalgia-associated pain and a reduction in symptoms? Symptoms that might include insomnia or daytime exhaustion and fatigue or depression. So they say the findings of this pilot trial suggest that LDN treatment in fibromyalgia is associated with a reduction of several key pro-inflammatory cytokines as well as symptoms. The potential role of LDN as an atypical anti-inflammatory medication should be explored further. Very cool. Research performed at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. Good stuff.